I'm Jonathan Tunick. Steve Sondheim and I share several interests, including a penchant for puns and anagrams. My own name yields very little in the way of anagrams, usually involving the word junk, but Steve's name is very rich, and my favorite is He Opens the Minds.
I remember once chatting with Steve and saying, isn't it amazing how so many more people were doing so many more of your productions, and you know, it's just building and building, it's just going to go on forever. And Steve just looked me in the eye and said, yeah, I get the cachet and you'll get the cash.
I'm looking around my living room. I don't think I've ever had in 30 years a creative meeting with Steve any place other than in his study. He reclines on the couch.
Yeah.
One sits facing him, and that's the pattern.
Even though I'm older than he is, he has always been the teacher. I've always trusted his advice, his word, as to how something should be approached, and he was always right.
If I talk to Steve on any subject, it's probably because I am so amazingly interesting, he is genuinely interested and keen and alive and still questioning, and it's fantastically contagious to be around because it's a child with an incredibly huge brain.
For those of you whose memories may be going, I'm Dimitri Weissman. Welcome to our first and last reunion.
He says he reads less than I do, which, you know, this brilliant mind. You know, he is completely unpretentious. And it's very interesting when people come up to him and start analysing his work and putting all sorts of theories into what it is and how I really understand you. And he just, in a very cool way, stands back and goes, you know, of course I think about my work. But actually, he's an old-fashioned showman. He wants to put on a Broadway show.
Maestro!
This confuses him whenever I say it, but I think he is perhaps the most rock and roll composer in the musical theater. I don't think I'll ever be able to convince him that it's true, but the way he's knocked down walls is nothing short of rock and roll to me.
A flower so fair, no rose can compare, nothing respectable, half so delectable.
Angela Lansbury, you are hours away from starting rehearsals for the indomitable Madame Armfelt in Little Night Music. And it occurred to me when I was thinking about this today that, I mean, your musical theatre journey began with Sondheim, didn't it? What, 45 years ago or something? Or was it?
Well, it was 1961.
It was a long time ago, but I mean, it was his Anyone Can Whistle, which was his second produced show as a composer-lyricist. What did you know about him at that time?
I just knew that he was, even in those days, considered a sort of wunderkind, you know, and I was just a beginning actress. Although I had certainly had a career in films in Hollywood, but I had sung in a couple of musicals, and I think it was due to that, and also some of the parts that I had played, particularly The Manchurian Candidate, that I think alerted both Stephen and Arthur Lawrence, the book writer, to the fact that if I could sing, I would be an ideal person to play Cora Hoover Hooper.
Yeah, you know? And you came in with a bang, because what an entrance number they gave you.
Everyone hates me, yes, yes. Being the mayoress, yes. All of the peasants throw rocks in my presence, which causes me nervous distress, yes.
Ooh. Listening to that album now, I mean, you went for it 105%, but I think you now look back and say, gosh, I was kind of A bit reckless?
Reckless is the word. I mean, I was... I've always said I screeched my way through that role. But when you have an opening stanza which says, "Everyone hates me, yes, yes, I am the mayoress, yes," you know, you're going to run with that, aren't you? I mean, that's a hell of an entrance. Absolutely. So I think I appreciated, as an actress, shall we say, more so than a singer, what it represented in the way of an opportunity to burst forth on the stage. Mm. You know.
What were your first impressions of Steve at that time? I mean, because presumably, being a new show, he was very actively involved in the process of...
He was and he wasn't. Steve has always managed to be, in a way, extremely discreet about his presence. He would never interfere in rehearsals. He would never take a position in front of the actors. If he had something to say, he'd say it later to the director or to the choreographer or whatever. And he, as I say, he was extremely thoughtful and very kind, because he's a very kind person.
I don't know whether you agree or not, but I think what singles him out, what makes him special, is that he doesn't just hang songs on a book. He really is a collaborator.
No, he integrates with the writer and the dialogue, and he told me the other evening, he's very, very careful and most loving about the work, not only of the writers, but also of the singers.
And that has to be
working.
That has to be a damn good reason for the song as well, doesn't there? That's
yes,
another thing.
Yes, and that's the thing. I think that's what's so evident in his work, is that it all works so marvellously for the story and for the characters.
You've done what? Three or four of his shows, if we include Gypsy, of course, which, you know, you must have a special place in his affections, I would have thought.
Well, let's say that we established a friendship and we've maintained it, definitely throughout these many years, I'm happy to say. And we look at one another sometimes and say, look where we've come from, you know. you know, and isn't it great? We're still doing it.
Not long ago, I was talking to Stephen Sondheim about his song, I'm Still Here. I told him that I had heard women in their 60s sing I'm Still Here, 50s even, and a couple of times in their 40s, I'm Still Here. Where have they been? I mean, it's ridiculous. And so I told him that, not that he asked me or anything, but I told him that I would never touch that song until I was, what, 80 years old. That makes sense to me. 80, I'm still here. But, you know, it is such a great song. I'm not going to wait 20 years to sing it.
Daniel Evans, I'm wondering what your relationship with musicals was, BS, before Sondheim.
pretty conventional, I would have to say. Obviously, my first introduction to theatre, as it was many people, especially coming from the Welsh Valleys, where there was lots of singing and lots of amateur acting companies doing musicals. So I played Oliver when I was 13 for the Pontypridd Amateur Operatic and Dramatic Society. And, you know, was coming to London and saw Les Mis and Chess and Children of Eden and, you know, all those musicals. But it did significantly change my relationship to musicals when I first heard a Stephen Sondheim song, which was not until I got to college in 1992 when I was 19.
Gosh, and what was that song?
It was Being Alive. It was Being Alive and Here's to the Ladies Who Lunch. And it was played to me. There were singing assessments at college, even though it's a classical theatre training course. And I had this bit of an old fogey teacher, can't remember his name, who was asking me which song did I want to, and he was an array of songs that I could choose from. And I remember him singing this song, The Ladies Who Lunch, and I was thinking, this is weird, this is a funny old song. And then, of course, it wasn't until much later when I ran out to get all the Sondheim albums that I heard Elaine Stritch singing, you know, "Here's to the Lady." But there was this guy going, "Here's to the ladies who lunch." It didn't make no sense at all, you know. But actually, when he played Being Alive, I could go beyond his voice and think, oh my God, what the hell is that song?
Someone to crowd you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through. Will always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. Being alive. Being alive. Being alive.
This is really controversial still, I think, but I think I would rather see an actor who could act a Sondheim song well and maybe not particularly sing it that great than to see an opera singer sing it beautifully but really couldn't act it at all. They are songs to be acted.
Yes.
I think Stephen is himself an actor. I think that's how he this is just my take on it. I wouldn't presume to, you know, suggest what he himself thinks, but from my experience of working with him, he approaches the music from the point of view of an actor. He puts himself in that character's position and thinks, how would they sound, how would they speak, how would they think at that moment? Mm. And therefore, it's like they are musical thoughts.
I know that Assassins was, as a spectator, was a show that made a big impression on you.
Huge.
Now, that was presumably the first Sondheim show you saw.
First Sondheim show I ever saw, and I was still in college, and I'd only just heard this Being Alive, maybe a year earlier, and had looked at other songs. But it was Assassins, really, that I was completely blown away by. And I remember coming out, and I said to the person I was with, this completely alters my view entirely of what musicals can do. The combination of the political, the personal, and the emotional that really just hit me right between the eyes. It was like a blow, and I really felt winded, and it was so shocking and moving and funny and witty. I've just wanted to see it immediately again afterwards.
And embrace so many styles that are, one could characterise as American.
Yes,
so many styles.
That's
of
right.
Music,
the pastiche is so, you know, expertly crafted in it. And for me, I mean, not only does the show refer to Arthur Miller, but it was like watching, you know, Attention Must Be Paid, is that great line from Death of a Salesman. But it was like for me watching one of those great American O'Neill Miller dramas. But using song, so that's when I actually did run out and buy all the albums.
It's great for establishing this very important fact, actually, about Sondheim, and that is his collaboration with book writers.
Right.
And John Wideman's book, I mean, it's one of those extraordinary shows where that last scene of the show...
God.
...where nobody sings until, there's a huge scene, because nobody needs to sing.
No, that's right. And it's an amazing moment, isn't it? Because it stops, it just becomes a play for a moment. Well, for a long moment.
A long moment.
Yeah. And then you have this amazing then canon of all the assassins coming forward begging Harvey Oswald to do it. You know, they all sort of come out of the shadows, don't they, and say, we're your family. You have to do it for us and inspire him to do this awful, awful deed. And how amazing.
Drama first.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Now,
just one more thing I wanted to say on that is that sometime when I was fortunate enough to do Sun in the Park in New York, and we were nominated for 9 Tonys, and Stephen that year won a Tony for a Lifetime Achievement. He wasn't there to accept it, but Mandy Patinkin gave the speech on his behalf. And what was amazing in that speech, which Steve obviously had written, was that he thanked more than anyone his collaborators and said that they were the people, and indeed he said so much to me personally, that they were the people who created the situations and the characters. And he really saw himself as just an interpreter, someone who, he says, took phrases, who took characters and just ran with them, but that the dramaturgs, the writers, were the people who made a hat where there never was a hat.
I said the man for me must have a castle. A man of means he'd be, a man of faith.
How, Prince, you and Steve Sondheim more or less evolved in tandem. You know, you seem to have been together from the very beginning.
Yes, well, a few years separate us in age. Two, actually. I'm older by two years. And when I met him, I was 20 and he was 18.
Hmm. What was the initial connection, do you think?
Oh, two very ambitious guys who wanted a life in the musical theater. Hmm. And the contemporary musical theater, as it was then, was really flourishing. There were so many composers, lyricists, directors, designers, and there was a real cachet mm-hmm. in being in the musical theater.
Tell me, if someone had asked you then, do you think this guy, Steve Sondheim, is going to change the face of musical theater? Would you have said, oh, yes?
Well, what I used to say to him, because I was successful first. Mm-hmm. I was older, and I produced before I directed, which is what I really wanted to do, and I produced successfully quite early on with my partner. So there were a number of years from 1954 to 1957 when we did West Side Story, which was not the happiest occasion for him because he was just doing the lyrics, and yeah. because I do believe when that show opened, he wasn't mentioned in the New York Times Review. And he did not want to be known as a lyricist. People used to say to me, why doesn't your friend just write lyrics? And I kept saying, because he writes great music. But I always thought he would be who he turned out to be. And I always said to him from the get-go, have a little patience, you will be hugely successful. It took some time. It always takes some time.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something.
The leap from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, his first show as a composer-lyricist, produced show, to Company was one of the biggest seismic leaps that we've ever seen in musical theatre. Now, how did Company come about? Your involvement with Company was there from the beginning.
Well, I was the one who said it would be a musical.
Okay.
Steve said to me, a friend of his had written 7 one-act plays, and they would make an evening.
George Firth.
For a famous actress, one of the best. And I said, look, I'll read them. He's very talented. They're fun. But all I can see is that lady in the wings, changing wigs, changing costumes, and rushing to follow herself on stage. It seems like a trick, not like a theater piece. And then I said, why don't you and George come into the office? I would like to propose something to you. And what I proposed was that I thought there was a musical in that material, a very unusual one, and that if you took the 7 plays, 3 of the existent ones, and then a 4th was written, all surrounded the subject of marriage, and that we ought to examine that, and ultimately we created a leading character, Bobby. And then Steve wrote the opening, which is as transcendent as anything. And then George wrote the birthday parties simultaneously, and the birthday parties were also very much in my head. They were weird, underwater, strangely hostile celebrations in which a group of friends, couples, married couples, celebrated the birthday of their single friend and competed for him, and we're not always nice to each other. And I thought that's the making of the piece. Mm-hmm. And then the process, George wrote very well, really well, but he wrote so well that he did not invite the intrusion or inclusion mm-hmm. of musical material. You did not want a character to suddenly stop and say, I love you. Sing, I love you. So the task from Steve's point of view was to write from outside and either interrupt a scene and do a song, or between scenes write a song that illustrated something. And he did that. So it's a very difficult assignment. And he would sit with a legal pad, and we would talk for hours, and he would ask questions about marriage, because I was married and had two kids, and he was not married, and he would want to know what I had to say about all that.
He's a great researcher, isn't he?
Yes, he is. We have a great difference, the two of us, in because I'm a great researcher, but I think it's a longing this expresses. He writes in pencil with an eraser, which means he's never ready to sign on. It's not true quite what I've said, but that's at least metaphorically what that means. I write in ink because I'd like not to change it.
Yeah.
So my scripts are very untidy because I write in ink, and then, of course, I have to cross out what I wrote and write some more in ink later on.
Yeah.
But that's two people coming from a different place.
Phone rings, door chimes, in comes company. No strings, good times, room hums company. Late nights, quick bites, party games, deep talks, long walks, telephone calls. Thoughts shared, souls bared, private names, all those photos up on the walls. With love.
Jonathan Tunick, you've orchestrated the vast majority of Sondheim shows, and although they're unmistakably Sondheim, they each have their own very, very distinct colour. How does it work with Steve? How much does he give you, and do you sit down and talk about, you know, the colour of the show and what he envisages, or is that...
It's a relationship that's evolved over the years. We don't really need to talk very much anymore. My first show with Steve was Company back in 1970. I was new in the business and wanted very much to please. And yet, my approach to Company was much closer than it might have been to a show by some other composer.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that people don't understand about arrangers and orchestrators is the speed at which they have to work, and a show in genesis, if you like, you're producing numbers individually, sometimes, I imagine, at very short notice, overnight, whatever. Does that still happen with Steve?
I'm just considering now that I'm often asked, how long does it take me to orchestrate a show? And my pat answer is, as much time as they give me minus 5 minutes. I saw a sign in the paint store up in the country, which I love, and I wish I could apply it to my work. It says, we offer three kinds of jobs. Fast, good, and cheap. You can have any two of the three.
That's excellent. Does he, from a technical point of view, does he give you short score or with indications of the kind of colors, or does
No.
he leave that to you?
No. He writes a fully realized piano accompaniment, very pianistic, much more complete than the old-time songwriters used to bother with. Their piano accompaniments tended to be perfunctory, bass and afterbeats and not much else.
Okay, so here's a fully harmonized and...
Yeah. In fact, when it comes to orchestrating, it becomes more a matter of cutting notes out than adding them.
Mm. Let's take one or two specific examples. One of the first things that struck me was when I heard Follies for the first time. And
well, Follies is back in another world,
okay,
you understand.
Okay, well...
We're still, and even more than Company, because there's so much pastiche in it. So we're aware that, oh, now we're doing Kern, you know, now we're doing...
That's what's
so amazing
about
Frimmel.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. But right from the start, when you, I mean, the atmosphere of the mysteriousness of this kind of empty theatre coming alive again at the beginning with those first measures, and then the piano intro into Beautiful Girls. But when the orchestra comes in, that is a thrilling moment.
Well, that's
it's
an effect. That's a calculated effect. And it's one you hear in every show when you have the orchestra rehearsal for the first time. And the people in the cast have been working in a drab rehearsal hall with the piano for 6 weeks. Well, not anymore. And then they come to orchestra rehearsal, and then there's this huge surge of energy that comes from new people.
Chabin, I think you came in where I came in, which was with company, but whereas I was just brought the LP by a friend who happened to have been to New York, I suspect you saw the show.
Several times.
Yeah. What was your first reaction?
The first time I saw Company at the then Alvin Theater, it was a complete mind-blowing experience because even though I had known elements of it and elements of the people involved, so there was enough expectation that this sounded like an interesting evening, I was not prepared for the totality of the experience, like open a window and a breath of fresh air. Everything that I loved in the musical theater was being done in ways that I never imagined could be done. But I was sitting next to a woman who had her bags, and at the end of it, she turned to me and said, "But what does it all mean?" I just thought, if you can't take anything from this, if you can't figure out what this means, then maybe you should have been at Hello Dolly.
It's funny, but when I put that LP on, when I first heard it, if ever something sucks you in from the very beginning, this does. And I just thought, this kind of urban counterpoint at the start of the piece, Which is
starting with that
so
busy
short.
Signal, yeah. Starting with that busy signal and that sound, that RMI Roxacord was the electronic keyboard that made that very very specific sound at the beginning of Company, and it was a sound that I'd never heard. Jonathan Tunick, I think, has said that he used that instrument in Promises, Promises a year or so earlier.
But it's important also that it is a sound of that time because you know we can place the piece in that time.
But I think one of the extraordinary things about Company was, growing up in New York, I certainly knew Sondheim as a lyricist, and I loved, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, in the same theater the Company was playing in, and nobody really gave that score the time of day, and I liked it. It was sort of a guilty pleasure to me, but it wasn't discussed much because the show was about the comedy, the low comedy, and even then there was the story of Jerome Robbins coming in to save the day and staging the opening number. But Stephen Sondheim as composer was never quite featured enough. However, he was clearly somebody who came out of the fine tradition of the American musical theater. So to hear in Company what sounded like a contemporary writer of popular music at the time was startling. And then as the show went on and you realized that the person schooled in traditional musical theater was every much at work writing this contemporary score.
Harry, you ever sorry you got married?
You're always sorry. You're always grateful. You're always wondering what might have been. Then she walks in.
And still there are a couple of course, iconic songs came out of that show. I mean, Ladies Who Lunch and Being Alive as well. Their context in the show gives them that extra something, extra punch, whatever you want to call it. But there's another song in the show which I think is the most perfect song ever written about the ambivalence of being married, and that's Sorry Grateful.
Yeah, Sorry, Grateful is one of those songs that the intellectual side of Sondheim as a lyricist can take an idea that is both appropriate and clever. By clever, I mean a collection of words that no one had quite ever thought to examine. And it's an emotional song. Again, people didn't think of Sondheim then as an emotional writer, and it's extremely emotional. And as you say, it goes right to the core of a kind of built-in, if not ambivalence, certainly tension in all of our lives about whether we want to take care of ourselves alone, whether we want to commit to some other thing, person, whatever. And it was an extraordinary song.
You don't live for her, you do live with her. You're scared she's starting to drift away, and scared she'll stay. Good things get better, bad get worse. Wait, I think I meant that in reverse. You're sorry, Grace.
Barbara Cook, can you actually remember when you first became aware of Stephen Sondheim? I mean, was it a song? Was it a show? Was it a... Can you remember?
Not really, because I've known Stephen for so long. I knew him socially before we had any kind of work together. Years and years and years ago. So I don't remember. And of course, I was certainly aware of Company and Follies as they came along. And definitely Sweeney Todd, and West Side Story, all those things. Mm. But I didn't really know him all that well. I know him a lot better now than I did in those years.
I suppose at a time when he was coming to great prominence, and it's been a long road, and he's been at the top for many, many years now, you were just kind of coming out of Broadway and going into cabaret and
concert. Well, not the early stuff, because when he did West Side Story, it was just around the Music Man time, that sort of thing. And in fact, there was some talk at one point about my doing Maria, and it's when I was doing Candide. And I remember Lenny, but they quite wisely decided to go with somebody, you know, with darker hair and all that.
The Wind, I should add, is doing its New York best today. It's fairly dramatic out there, if people can hear it. There was that momentous concert performance of Follies. I just wondered whether you'd ever wish you'd played Sally Durant on stage.
Well, I wanted to play it originally, but I didn't get an audition. What happened is that there were auditions for Hal on two successive days. The first one was for the Countess, I guess she's called, in Zorba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that role, and then the next day it was an audition for Follies. And I hadn't sung in New York in a while, and I hadn't, there were rumors about, you know, why is she doing this, that, and the other. Some, in fact, all of them were incorrect. But I wanted to go in looking healthy and young and blah, 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 and so forth. And I evidently succeeded too well, because Hal called that afternoon after I'd seen him about Zorba. He called my agency that afternoon and said, she just looks too healthy. She looks too good, because we want somebody who's, they would try, actually they did cast people who were kind of, oh, this sounds terrible, on a downward road, you know, as far as their careers go. And of course there's a thing called acting that they were not paying much attention to in their casting, I suppose. So I was not allowed to audition for it. I was angry as hell, as you can imagine. But they wouldn't see me. So, yeah. I don't know.
Well, that concert performance was amazing. One of the things about Follies that I think is so extraordinary is the way Steve managed to characterize the kind of the book songs, if you like, which were the songs that the real people sang in about their lives particular time, and the Follies song,
the pastiche song,
exactly, which sounds so familiar. You think, I've known this song all my life. It's so skillful,
very, very skillful. Well, I think it's one of his best scores by far. Some beautiful, beautiful work in there.
It's characterized.
One More Kiss is just, it's a gorgeous song, isn't it?
It is,
That's one that just seems to have been plucked out of the air, doesn't it?
Yeah. But with Sally, the two sides of her character, I mean, in Buddy's Eyes, which is just an extraordinary song because the whole thing is a lie, and Losing My Mind, which is the Follies song. Talk about those two songs, because you've sung them many times in your...
Well, you know, in the script, in the show, of course the song is a lie. But I chose not to take that into consideration when I was doing it, because, you know, sometimes we're never more believable than when we're lying. And so I decided to do it as if it were the realest thing in the world and the most honest thing, because we weren't doing the whole script, and it just seemed pointless to me to try to bring that element in rather than just singing the song as purely and honestly as I knew how.
Life is slow, but it seems exciting, 'cause Buddy's there. Gourmet cooking and letter writing, and knowing Buddy's there. Every morning, don't faint, I tend the flowers. Can you believe it? Every weekend, I paint.
A lot of it is a pastiche score, no question. No question.
But it's such good pastiche that it transcends.
Oh, I don't think pastiche is ever bad. It's just, how good is it?
Yeah.
And this pastiche was very deliberate. I think every once in a while there's a little bit of snob about Steve that he was doing pastiche, but no one ever did it better, and it's appropriate to the piece.
It's so important to understand the rules before you break them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, why he's such a pivotal character in the history of the musical is, I mean, he's often spoken of a mentorship with Oscar Hammerstein. He has said that Oscar taught him the rules of how a musical worked, or certainly in a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical worked. And Sondheim was like a sponge, just taking it all in. And what's so interesting is, having taken it all in the Hammerstein way of construction, and sometimes leaning on that, but most often taking what he learned and thinking, well, I can actually push this a little this way, and I can push this a little that way, or I can decide that it's going to be more a psychological question than a moment of advancing the plot.
I'm young, I'm beautiful, in a body's arms, on body's shoulder.
I understood that show as well as any show I've ever done, and I can see it, every single moment of it. And Steve wrote every single moment of it. It was a real rewrite job, you know. When I came into it, it was called The Girls Upstairs, and it wasn't that. It was very realistic. Then we really went for the past and the present, mm-hmm. and then the collision of the past and the present. And instead of physical confrontation at the end of the play, it was an emotional confrontation. And the four young versions of the leads and the four contemporary versions of the lead just collided on stage and started to scream at each other. And then the Follies grew out of that.
Yeah. I believe there are 7 songs that ended up in the final score of Follies that were not written when the show went into rehearsal, which is an incredibly foolish thing for anybody to do. Part of the reason, of course, was because the Follies sequence at the end was still forming and they didn't quite know how they were going to do it. However, Yvonne DiCarlo's song, Can That Boy Foxtrot, it was deemed by the time the show got to Boston that it wasn't the right song for her. And Sondheim had expanded it beyond its one-joke status. A lot was going on in Boston, and, you know, Steve would come to the theater occasionally and then disappear, and nobody knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, some did, I didn't. And then one day I was handed this manuscript and asked to type out a set of lyrics, because this was Yvonne's new song, and it had been played for Michael Bennett and Harold Prince, and it had been played for Yvonne. And so I went up to the stage manager's office and, you know, rolled the carbon papers into an old typewriter. And I, you know, what I will never forget is, you know, to the left of the typewriter, there was Sondheim's manuscript. And I, by that point, I had learned pretty much how he liked lyrics to be typed in script format, all caps, you know, the word every, E-V-E-R-Y if it's in the script, E-V-R-Y on the music, because that's the way you sing it, every, that kind of stuff. So I felt pretty good about it. But as I'm typing out these images and these lyrics, not knowing what the music was, I'm just, my mind is blown. It's one more brilliant image of the Depression, of that era, and so skillfully put together, and so you know, clever in the right way when it needed to be. And I just remember thinking, I can't wait to hear what the music sounds like, because these lyrics are, this is amazing. And you know, this was long before Google. I mean, you know, it looked like somebody else would have had to go into a library for a week to do research about all these things. Now, it turns out that, you know, it's the era that Stephen Sondheim grew up in, so he knows, and he knew who Brenda Fraser was, who was the, you know, the first person who was famous for being famous, you know, and Amos and Andy and all those. So anyway, it was a wonderful experience typing out these lyrics, and I still have a copy of that sheet that I typed out that day, and the song was indeed called I'm Here.
I've been through Gandhi, Wally and Windsor's affair, but I'm here. Amos and Andy, Marjan and platinum hair, but I'm here.
There was one line, I got through three commercials and I'm here. And shortly afterwards, that was changed to I got through five commercials, because if you say through three and then try to sing through three, the tongue is working overtime. So through five was easier to sing, and it stayed that way for a while, and then one day it changed to I'm almost through my memoirs. And it's, you know, you realize it's an artist at work, an absolute craftsman.
Gee, that was fun and a half. When you've been through Herbert and J. Edgar Hoover, anything else is a laugh.
How is Steve as a collaborator? I mean, what are his?
Totally exciting. We've had absolutely wonderful times. We came to the end of the 10-year collaboration, which was for 9.5 of them extremely successful, and then we did Merrily. And it did not do well, and I think it was just time.
Why did it? It's such a great score.
It's a great score. It's not a great book. The book is what does it in. George wrote fine, but it's too confusing, and I never got a handle on what it should look like. I did, really, but I didn't have the guts. I called my office force in one day, and I said, this is a Broadway musical, and it's supposed to be it's going to cost whatever it's going to cost. It's supposed to be a big Broadway musical. And the only thing I can think of is a bare stage. And they kept saying, what do you mean? I said, I just keep thinking a bare stage with a lot of costume racks and a lot of kids just putting it together and behaving like adults and putting on clothes that they think are appropriate to the scenes they play. And I'd love to do it on a bare stage. And they said, then do it. And I was too cowardly. Now, would it have worked? I don't know. But certainly we made it better and better. And by the time it closed on Broadway, it was really quite a good show. The problem was that we were too damn famous then, together as a team. There was just too much hope out there and too much expectation. If I had done what I really wanted to do, would it have worked? No, because the plot was too complicated. But I wanted to do the other, and so did Steve. Let's take the kids and show them so glisteny and see what happens to them over the course of a lifetime. Good idea for a show, just too complicated.
How did you get here from there?
This is an interview, isn't it, with
yes.
Charlie?
Live on television.
Live on television at the point where they're in the ascendant very much.
That's
and,
right.
And there's a whole corporation is
yes.
evolving around Franklin Shepard.
In fact, they are almost, I would say, over the hill. Things have started to really go wrong, especially between them. Frank has gone out to L.A., and is producing films and keeps saying to Charlie, "Oh yeah, we'll do a show. And how do you fancy some more money?" Mm-hmm. And that really causes a huge resentment in Charlie, because he feels that not only has he been abandoned by his best friend, but his best friend has abandoned their principles and their original passion and integrity, which is where they started. Which, of course, you eventually get to see.
And soon we're tapping away. Sorry, Charlie. Secretary, on the intercom. Yes, Miss Biz. It's a messenger. Thanks, Miss Biz. Would you tell him to wait? Would you order the car? Would you call up the bank? Would you wire the coast? Would you... Sorry, Charlie. Mutter, 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 sell the stock. Mutter, buy the rights. Mutter, 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 mutter. Let me put you on hold. Yes, Miss Biz, it's the interview. Thanks, Miss Biz. Will you tell him to wait? Will you wire the car? Will you order the coast? Will you set up a bank? And the telephones blink and the stocks get sold and the rest of us he keeps on hold and he's gonna start producing and he's now a corporation, right? And I play at home with my wife and kids and I wait to hear the movie bids and I got a little sailboat and I'm in a meditation, right? He flies off to California. I discuss him with my shrink. That's the story of the way we work. Me and Franklin Shepard, Inc.
That's not a song, that's a nervous breakdown, isn't it? It's
and I had a few of them, let me tell you. Yes, during learning it, I had a few of them.
Let's talk about that song, because it is a scene, isn't it? Like so many of Sondheim's great numbers. And it has this wonderful still center to it that is terribly moving, where he suddenly realizes what he could be losing, this friendship.
Yes.
You did a one-to-one with Steve with this song. Tell us about that.
He was very strict, to the point where I was really quite afraid of him at the time. It was Gareth Valentine, a brilliant MD at the piano, and we were in the Donmar Bar, not the greatest of places to be having a masterclass, you know, one-on-one masterclass with Stephen Sondheim. But you know, what really struck me, it was during that hour that we had just on Franklin Shepard, Inc., that I realised what Stephen was, in the sense of how he approached and how he created his work. And that was because he started by telling me, now look, that morning Charlie has got up, and he took me through the entire morning. He took me through what his wife had said to him, how she picked out the clothes for him, what was up to the last thing that he worried about before going onto the studio floor, and that was the fact that his flies were done up. So there was me worrying about all these extraneous stuff, as a stupid young actor does. And Stephen had said to me, the last thing you need to worry about before going on stage is whether your flies are done up.
It's extraordinary. You talk about Steve giving you a context for that number. But the number itself takes you on such a journey.
Yes.
And the virtuosity of the number, because you are a number of different voices as well.
That's right. You're the secretary. You're all the things that Franklin Shepard asks for. You know, the wire to be money. No, here we go. I'm actually making mistakes now, which I often did. He wants money to be wired. He wants cars to be brought, prepared and...
But then he does get it all
right.
He does get
it wrong. Then he wants cars to be wired and monies to be prepared and all of that, which, sometimes I said right, sometimes I said them wrong. But it is an amazing, it is a nervous breakdown through song.
Can you remember the words of that middle section when he says, you know?
Yes. Nothing permanent has happened, just a temporary kink. Friendship's something you don't really lose. And then he has this big realization. Oh my God, I think it's happened. But there is a little tiny bit of dialogue which is really useful in the middle of it, where he says, "Stop, stop! I think I'm getting in too deep." And he starts to realize that he is on television and that he is maybe embarrassing his friend. And then he really speaks from the heart and says to the interviewer, almost as if Frank isn't there, you see, friendship is like a garden. You have to water and tend it for it to grow. And I want it back. Which I think is something really... a very vulnerable place, and perhaps he doesn't even know how vulnerable he is at that point. But I think that's the real subject of the whole piece, in a way, of how really love and relationships over time, if we're not careful, get eroded by external materialistic...
They need attention, they have to be nurtured.
Yes.
Actually, just hearing you do that shivers down the spine, because, you know, I remember one of the things about that number is that it's screamingly funny.
Yes.
But it is also heartbreaking.
Tragic.
And on a sixpence.
Yes,
the change
right,
of mood.
Right. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
And that is the genius of Stevenson.
Yeah, it's a gift really for an actor, you know. It's terrifying, but it's a gift.
Go get a drink. That's the guy I love, the fella who's inside. Mutter, quick, Jerome, get the president. There's a crazy man on my TV screen. Inside, drink. Inside, Franklin Shepard. Just light him, Kevin.